Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Monday, May 18th, 2026, for our dedicated Startups Edition.
Today, we are examining the shift from growth at all costs to the era of disciplined efficiency. We are tracking how capital allocation is moving away from raw user acquisition and toward the hardening of unit economics and structural durability.
It's no longer about how fast you can run, but how much weight you can carry.
Consider this, we begin by analyzing the mechanics of scaling culture and operational excellence, specifically how leadership maintains cohesion during rapid headcount expansion. From there, we move into the frontier of AI productivity, the reemergence of the physical and industrial stack, and the evolving landscape of digital agency. Finally, we will conclude with a deep dive into mastering the modern fundraising playbook.
Let's start with the fundamentals of organizational scaling. Todd Graves, the CEO of Raising Cane's, recently made a move that sounds like a nightmare for any venture capitalist. He essentially decided to stop franchising and move to a 100% company-owned model. Today, we're looking at the mechanics of scaling culture and operational excellence, specifically, how you grow an enterprise without it turning into a hollowed-out version of its original self.
It's a move designed to prevent performance drift, where Graves found that even high-performing franchisees were operating at a 10% to 15% lower quality threshold than company stores. By controlling every unit, he ensures that the operational simplicity, the one-thing strategy of a limited, craveable menu, remains intact as the footprint expands.
Right, because nothing kills a craveable brand faster than a franchisee deciding that adding a side of loaded fries is a great way to juice their quarterly margins.
And that's the core tension in scaling, the death by a thousand cuts phenomenon. As Graves warns, when private equity enters the equation, the pressure to cut costs often targets the very cultural elements that drive speed and service, like the quality of music in the restaurant or the centralization of sauce production. These micro decisions degrade frontline morale and eventually the brand's fundamental competitive advantage.
It sounds like a classic case of the boardroom accidentally lobotomizing the frontline.
It is, and you see the same structural risks in much larger, more complex financial institutions. On Bloomberg Surveillance, Lloyd Blankfein argued that managing large organizations requires a culture of ownership where compensation is tied to the entire firm's performance, rather than individual silos. Without that, you end up with fragmented business units that optimize for their own fund objectives, maximizing carry with minimal headcount, while ignoring the firm objectives, which are the long-term compounding institutional advantages.
So you're telling me the solution to corporate fragmentation is just paying everyone the same way? That feels a bit like solving a leaky dam with a piece of scotch tape.
It's less about tape and more about creating a partnership culture through compensation structures that force disparate units to collaborate on the most profitable collective path. It's about moving from a collection of talented individuals to a team driven by shared processes. Tony James, building out Blackstone, noted that scaling requires replacing difficult siloed experts with a cohesive group that uses process to enhance decision-making rather than creating bureaucracy.
But how do you actually audit that? If the experts are the ones in charge of the data, a standard audit is just a performance review of their own successes.
That's a massive single point of failure. Blankfein suggests that the most effective audits bypass senior leadership and target mid-level managers to capture an unfiltered view of operational reality. He also advocates for intentional redundancy in communication. A leader should listen to the same information from multiple different levels. If the message is consistent, it validates the reality. If it's not, you can identify where the information is being filtered or self-censored.
I love the idea of a leader just sitting there, hearing the same thing three times and acting like it's a revelation. It's essentially professional eavesdropping.
It's a way to assess the caliber of the messenger. But there's a deeper layer to this, the cultural crucible. At Blackstone, James noted that high-performance investment committees serve as the mechanism to transmit analytical rigor and values from senior management down to junior staff. The quality of engagement in those meetings serves as a direct signal to the entire organization about the required standard of excellence.
So if you show up to a meeting and don't notice a decimal error, you've effectively signaled that the company's standards are optional.
The implication runs deeper. The stakes are higher than just looking sharp. You have to view junior cohorts as long-term reputation assets. Blankfein points out that the way you treat employees today creates sticky memories and grudges that influence how those individuals will lead institutions decades from now. If you burn them now, you're essentially poisoning your future talent pipeline.
Which is a pretty expensive way to save on a payroll budget.
It's an investment in stability. You can even use growth as a retention tool. Instead of a war of slash M.
Alex, if you found out your entire department's productivity was about to drop by nearly 20% just so they could learn how to use a new spreadsheet, would you call that a strategic upgrade or just a very expensive way to induce a midlife crisis?
Well, if you're looking at the data from Microsoft's recent internal rollout, it's actually much more dramatic than that, Adoption of Copilot actually plummeted from 22% down to 5% in certain segments during the transition.
So we're talking about the AI productivity frontier, where the headline is innovation, but the reality is a sudden, sharp descent into chaos.
We can trace that further, and what we're seeing is the productivity J-curve, a concept popularized by Erik Brynjolfsson. The mechanism is simple. You introduce a transformative tool which breaks all your existing efficient workflows, forcing a period of high-effort experimentation where performance actually dips before it recovers.
It's like buying a high-end, automated espresso machine that requires a chemistry degree to operate. You start off drinking instant coffee and lukewarm water while you figure out the pressure settings, and for a few weeks, you're just exhausted and caffeinated by sheer panic.
That's a perfect way to frame the competency trap. According to research discussed on Cold Call, your most efficient, high-performing employees, the ones who have mastered every manual shortcut and keyboard command, are actually the most resistant to AI. Their established mastery makes the learning cost of a new experimental tool a net negative to their current output.
So the people who are best at their jobs are the ones most likely to sabotage the rollout because they actually like being able to get things done without a chatbot intermediating.
Worth noting, if management doesn't decouple learning from performance metrics, meaning if they don't guarantee that employees won't be penalized for that temporary dip, the talent will just revert to their old manual ways to protect their metrics.
Which leads us to the super producers. If the veterans are resisting, what happens to the newcomers who don't have any old ways to defend?
That's where the landscape shifts toward what Mark Andreessen describes as the builder culture. We're seeing the collapse of traditional roles, where the lines between programmer, product manager, and designer are blurring into a single autonomous unit. In the most extreme cases, the A16Z show highlights the AI vampire phenomenon, where developers using tools like Claude or Codex enter this hyperproductive state, working much longer, more intense hours driven by the euphoria of unprecedented output.
AI vampire sounds less like a productivity boost, and more like a way to ensure the next generation of tech talent is permanently sleep-deprived and fueled by nothing but the dopamine hit of a successful deployment.
It's a massive multiplier. We're talking about a potential 20 times productivity increase for top-tier programmers compared to even a year ago. This doesn't necessarily lead to fewer jobs, but it does lead to labor expansion. As the cost of creating code drops, the demand for much larger volumes of new products skyrockets, which actually creates more work, even if it requires fewer people per project.
But there's a catch for the people who actually have to manage these vampires and their automated agents, right? It's not all just writing code faster.
No, because we are moving from managing administrative pipelines to managing agentic AI, systems that can act autonomously through an entire sales or development lifecycle. But as noted on Cold Call, the primary obstacle to scaling these autonomous agents isn't the technical capability, it's the difficulty of encoding high variance work. That's the work that requires human judgment to weigh a single, seemingly insignificant sentence in an email more heavily than the rest of the context.
The AI can handle the 70% of the boring B2B sales admin, but it still hits a wall when it has to decide if a client is being subtly sarcastic or genuinely unhappy.
So here's the picture. The strategic value for a startup or a large org like Microsoft lies in role rechartering. You use AI to automate the transactional, high-overhead tasks, which allows the human to pivot toward high-value strategic consulting and relationship building. As Ben Horowitz has argued, when models like Opus 4.6 handle the PRDs and the routine documentation, human competitive advantage shifts toward what is irreducible: original creativity, developing taste, and managing high-fidelity relationships.
I love the idea of taste being the new moat. It's much harder to automate a preference for elegance than it is to automate a summary of a meeting.
But there is a systemic risk to that shift. The A16Z show warns about the erosion of intellectual intuition. When you use an opaque, automated backend, you lose the visible trail of error, like a mispriced trade in a traditional trading room, that allows humans to catch mistakes before they scale. We're entering an era of untestable reliability, where the danger isn't that the AI is dumb, but that we can't verify its correctness fast enough to prevent a coordinated failure.
It sounds like the more we automate, the more we're just building a massive high-speed engine where we've accidentally removed the dashboard and the brakes.
And for a startup, the temptation is to just floor it. But successful scaling requires social levers, not just technical training. The most effective strategy we've seen is pairing the tech-savvy AI-native juniors with the respected anti-tech veterans. The veterans provide the organizational credibility, and the juniors provide the implementation.
It's a way to trick the old guard into adopting the tools that might eventually make their manual shortcuts obsolete.
It's less about trickery and more about survival. If you don't manage the transition through that J-curve, you're left with slop, a term used in Masters of Scale to describe the failure of AI to produce consistent, high-quality output at scale, which eventually ruins the user experience.
Implication: venture capitalists need to shift their due diligence from evaluating a startup's headcount efficiency to evaluating the taste and proprietary workflow integration of their core engineering team. One thing to watch for the first major agentic failure in a high-stakes industry, where an autonomous system makes a decision based on a misinterpreted nuance, because that will be the moment the untestable reliability fear turns into a regulatory mandate. Building the physical and industrial stack. For the last 2 years, the venture community has been obsessed with the brains of AI, the weights, the parameters, the transformer architectures. But it turns out the real bottleneck isn't how smart the model is, it's how much copper and electricity we can shove into it.
We're moving from the era of pure software to the era of the physical stack. On the A16Z show, the argument was made that AI dominance is fundamentally a physical infrastructure challenge rather than a purely algorithmic one, because the expansion of large models creates these inescapable dependencies on energy generation, grid-scale transmission, and mineral extraction.
Less prompt engineering, more mining engineering.
And it's a massive gap to close. Turner Caldwell of Mariana Minerals noted that the U.S. is effectively 50 years behind in critical mineral supply. To fix this, he's proposing a minerals mandate, basically using long-term government incentives to create the market certainty needed to move private capital into heavy extraction and refining.
Which sounds incredibly expensive and incredibly slow. I assume we're just going to wait for the lithium to spontaneously appear in Nevada.
Not quite. The strategy is to use the very technology we're trying to power to fix the supply chain. Caldwell suggests using reinforcement learning and autonomy in refineries to increase efficiency and essentially remove humans from the loop. It's about turning a legacy, manual industry into a high-precision, autonomous one.
I love the idea of a robot doing the digging so we can focus on the much harder task of writing better Python scripts.
But you can't ignore the hardware. Drew Beglino of Heron Power emphasized that we have to leverage domestic tech, like silicon carbide, for manufacturing to ensure the economic benefits stay in the country. If we don't prioritize domestic power semiconductor production, the entire value of the AI boom just leaks out to geopolitical rivals.
It's a bit of a frantic scramble, isn't it? We're building an entire industrial base while everyone is staring at their LLM benchmarks.
It is, but the opportunity for startups is massive. The A16Z show argued that true entrepreneurial opportunity lies in identifying and solving supply-side shortages, things like power transformers, chips, or cooling, rather than merely iterating on existing software models. If you can solve the thermal management of a data center, you're arguably more valuable than the person building the next chatbot.
Even the talent pool is a mess. You can't find enough power electronics engineers.
Right, so the move is analog hiring. The A16Z show suggested that to overcome the scarcity of specialized engineers, leaders need to pivot to sourcing technical talent from high-speed, high-precision industries like bottling or syringe production. The physics of moving liquid in a vaccine vial isn't that far from the physics of managing flow in a battery manufacturing line.
The future of AI might actually be built by people who spend their careers making sure soda bottles are filled correctly.
It's all part of the same loop. We need the minerals, which needs the energy, which needs the autonomous refineries, which needs the hardware, which needs the specialized engineers.
Implication: Series A investors should start looking at companies with high capex and heavy industrial IP rather than just high-margin SaaS. One thing to watch: the first major announcement of a domestic large-scale silicon carbide fabrication plant, because that will tell us if the hardware-first thesis is actually getting any real capital. The new frontier of digital agency. We're starting today by discussing the rise of vibe geopolitics, where tech CEOs basically try to run international relations based on their own personal moral compasses. It sounds like a bad plot from a cyberpunk novel, but it's actually what we're seeing in the new frontier of digital agency.
It's a massive shift in how power is distributed, Maya. We're moving away from centralized content choke points toward a model of digital freedom, where the goal isn't just fixing the dollar, but building entirely independent, voluntary alternatives.
Right, because apparently the old way of managing the internet, which was let's just have some centralized, opaque authorities decide what's true, is officially broken.
On Bloomberg Surveillance, the panel noted that the real threat to human agency is a vision of safety, where people voluntarily trade away their privacy to superintelligent AI companies or foreign governments just to feel protected from an unstable world.
We're basically trading our souls for a really efficient firewall.
It's more about the technical mechanism of resistance. On the A16Z show, analysts argue that crypto can act as a coordination layer for decentralized compute, allowing us to crowdfund GPUs and create models where the participants, not just the giants, actually own the training data.
I mean, I'll admit, the idea of money that moves as quickly as you can talk to it sounds great for a startup, but aren't we just replacing one set of algorithms with another?
Not if we use the right tools. As the crypto fund Five Speakers pointed out, the intersection of AI and blockchain means AI agents can act as autonomous economic actors, using natural language to manage programmable stablecoin payments. This turns what used to be recreational coding into a simple managerial task for anyone.
I honestly can't tell if we're discussing a technological utopia or a very expensive way to automate our own obsolescence.
It's about creating sanctuaries, which is a term Vitalik Buterin has used to describe technologies that don't try to govern the whole world, but instead focus on protecting privacy and agency within specific digital spaces. This is critical because, as the A16 Times show noted, we're seeing shadow star chambers, high-powered NGOs that exert massive influence via deplatforming without any democratic oversight.
And for the founders listening, this isn't just a philosophical debate about freedom, it's a scaling problem.
There's a signal here: zero-knowledge cryptography is the engine here. It allows a system to move from every node verifying every transaction to a model of proofs that could theoretically allow for millions of transactions per second. However, we have to watch for Jevons' paradox, where the massive surge in transactions driven by these AI agents might actually increase demand for block space so fast that it outpaces any cost reductions.
So the more efficient we make the network, the more expensive it potentially becomes because the AI agents never stop consuming.
The data tells a story for a startup: privacy is becoming the definitive moat. By using cryptography to encrypt user data, developers can create much higher switching costs, preventing users from migrating to competing chains.
Implication: seed stage investors should reevaluate their thesis on AI-only plays and start looking for the crypto infrastructure layers that provide the identity and data ownership these agents will require. One thing to watch: the next major regulatory crackdown on content-neutral platforms in the EU, because if it triggers a wave of corporate self-censorship, it will prove that regulatory liability is effectively killing global digital competition. Mastering the fundraising playbook. Most founders treat fundraising like a desperate plea for help, but I think the best way to actually get a check is to treat your investors like they're the ones being audited.
It's less about an audit and more about manufacturing a deadline. As Charlie O'Donnell suggests, you need time binding, implementing a rigid 2-week window for decisions to create a controlled closing window. This forces investors to act quickly or risk being bypassed, which effectively prunes your pipeline of dead leads.
The strategy is essentially act busy or get left behind.
The pattern is clear: it signals quality to the top tier of investors. But you can't just create pressure, you have to provide a narrative that survives the internal game of telephone among partners. O'Donnell argues for a bite-sized approach, like an X for Y formula. You need a hook anchored in financial scale, not social utility. Instead of pitching a fix for literacy, you pitch an $80 billion inefficient industry.
I see.
Move the saving the world part to the appendix and lead with the massive profitable mess.
Two things stand out. You prioritize your strongest pillar, whether that's market, team, or traction, and push the weaker elements to the end before attention wanes. And don't mistake polite interest for a deal. As FOMO sapiens with Patrick J. McGinney's notes, high-intensity, strenuous debate with an investor is actually a more positive signal than polite engagement. If they aren't challenging your claims, they likely aren't invested.
So if they're being difficult, they actually like you. That's a terrifying way to run a business.
It's about tracking tangible movement through the firm's hierarchy. A deal is only approaching a landing zone when you see specific progress, like moving from a principal meeting to a partner meeting. You aren't defending your past achievements, you are selling tickets to the future. If you get a rejection, don't just walk away. Treat it as actionable data to identify if the doubt lies in your market size or your team.
Implication: seed stage founders must stop tracking likes and start tracking the specific internal milestones required to move a deal toward a sign check. One thing to watch: if your next pitch meeting feels too easy, assume the investor has already decided to pass. As we wrap up this edition, a clear thread emerges from today's deep dives. The era of frictionless, software-only growth has hit a hard ceiling. Whether we are discussing the operational decay seen in franchise expansion or the temporary efficiency dip during massive AI integration, the common denominator is a sudden, unavoidable encounter with complexity. We are moving out of a period of pure digital abstraction and into a much heavier, more integrated reality.
It's a telling detail. The single most critical implication here is for the Series B and C founders, who have spent the last few years optimizing for user acquisition and code deployment. Your primary strategic obligation is shifting from scaling your user base to securing your physical and operational foundations. This means the founder's calculus must pivot from managing virtual workflows to auditing the physical stack, securing the energy, minerals, and manufacturing pipelines that actually permit your software to scale. If you haven't addressed your dependency on the underlying industrial infrastructure, your next massive surge in computational demand won't be a growth milestone, it will be a catastrophic bottleneck.
It's the transition from being a digital architect to becoming a logistics strategist.
Something to flag here to see if this thesis is holding: keep a close eye on the upcoming quarterly earnings reports from the major semiconductor and energy utilities. If we see a sudden divergence where massive capital expenditure is being diverted specifically toward domestic power grid upgrades and raw material stockpiling, it confirms that the market is finally pricing in the physical constraints of the AI revolution.
That's the signal to watch. Thanks for joining us for this Monday edition. We'll see you next week.